Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Ewan Graham, the Director of the International Security Programme here, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all to this lecture titled The Australia-Japan Relationship in an Increasingly Insecure Region. I'm delighted to welcome our special guest, Professor Akiko Fukushima, to the Institute. Professor Fukushima is based at the School of Global Studies in Aoyama Gakuin University in Tokyo, and she's also a senior fellow at the Tokyo Foundation. She has also served as a member of Prime Minister Abe's Advisory Council on National Security since 2013, and also the Advisory Council of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs since 2014, and has a long, illustrious career, including having played a role in writing Japan's national security strategy. This lecture is generously supported by the Japanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, so let me also recognise and welcome Consul General Takewaka in the front row and his team who are joining us here today. Professor Fukushima, the floor is yours.
Dr. Graham, thank you very much for your kind introduction. It is my distinct honor and privilege to speak here today at the Lowy Institute this year, which marks the 60th anniversary of Japan-Australia Agreement on Commerce and 10th anniversary of the Japan-Australia Joint Declaration on Security Cooperation. As a matter of fact, I was involved in Japan-Australia political security cooperation since year 2000. That was a time when we didn't have substantive security cooperation. But I said, we are U.S. allies, and despite our geographical distance, we share values and interests. Therefore, we should be able to do things together. We can compare notes as well. So I was very delighted when two governments signed the Japan-Australia Joint Declaration on Security Cooperation. And since then, we have made many milestones in enhancing our cooperation. Today, I would like to share my thoughts on the future of Australia-Japan relationship in an increasingly insecure Indo-Pacific, Asia-Pacific region. When you drive your car, you use your navigation map, don't you? So I think that it is fair enough for me to give you my navigation map for today. First, I will discuss how a Japanese scholar perceives current security environment in the region. Second, I will talk on how Japan has responded to security environment in recent years. Three, then I will discuss how Japan will address increasing uncertainties, bearing in mind possible changes in the U.S. Asia policy. At the very end, as a food for thought, I will explore how Japan and Australia, as the like-minded U.S. allies and as a bilateral special strategic partner, can proactively develop strategies and policies to cooperate for peace and security of respective nations, the region, and beyond, together and separately. And I would like to spend more time for my last point. Now, as my navigation is in front of you, let me start from my first point. I, as a Japanese scholar, have perceived the security environment worsening in the region, in particular in my neighborhood, Northeast Asia. The worsening is taking place in the last decade. China is building up their military capabilities and is thickening presence in South China Sea and East China Sea. North Korea is taking provocative actions, developing and testing multiple missiles, even ICBM, and nuclear warheads, which can easily come to the Japanese archipelago and beyond. As a scholar, was invited to Pyongyang twice in my life and had extraordinary experiences. And I have been explained why they have to develop missiles and nuclear weapons. However, I'm not persuaded. I hasten to add that security concerns do not stop there. We face diversified security threats, such as cyber, terrorism, pandemics, large-scale natural disasters, and fragility, which may lend its hand to recurring conflicts. According to the World Bank data, 44% of conflicts ceased, recurs in 5 years after the peace accord. While the broader scope of security threat perceptions, such as pandemics, was harshly criticized in the 1990s, excessive securitization, such criticism has disappeared today. Moreover, we are concerned with compounded risks involving plural number of these elements. Yet, we now face a new uncertainty of a foreign and security policy of the Trump administration in the United States. The United States, in my eyes, has been a source of stability in the region with its pivot or rebalancing to Asia. We do not yet know whether the Trump administration will maintain such a policy or not. We do not yet know whether the U.S. will bear the leadership in maintaining liberal international order like successive American governments after World War II. Any vacuum in the region created by such may invite great power rivalry. I wonder where we can find a new keystone of peace, stability, and prosperity. So, in my eyes, security environment in Asia, particularly in Northeast Asia, is worsening. Now, turning to my second point, how Japan has responded to the worsening security environment in the recent past. Japan has taken numerous initiatives to respond, but in the interest of time, let me give three. First, Japan has made its strategy clear. Japan has announced its national security strategy for the first time in 2013, which I was personally involved in drafting. The strategy symbolized Japanese shift from passive and reactive foreign and security policy to proactive ones. The national security strategy specifically gave three objectives. One, Japan to strengthen the deterrence necessary for maintaining Japan's peace and security and survival. This is to deter threats from directly reaching Japan. Second objective is for Japan to improve the security environment of the Asia-Pacific region and reduce direct threats to Japan through strengthening the Japan-U.S. Security Alliance, as well as through enhancing trust and cooperative relationship with partners and promoting practical security cooperation with like-minded countries. Third, Japan to improve global security environment and to build a peaceful, stable, and prosperous international community by strengthening international order based on shared values and rules, and by playing a proactive role in the settlement of disputes. When we announced this national security strategy in December 2013, we also announced a new midterm defense program outline, which enabled us to implement what we have said in the strategy. The national security strategy also put out Japan's foreign and security policy of proactive contribution to peace based on principle of international cooperation. Amongst the three objectives that I have just enumerated, the second and third has a relevance to today's topic, and I would like to expand later. A second initiative that Japan has taken on in addition to national security strategy was introduction of the new peace and security legislation. This has allowed Japan to exercise right to collective self-defense, though limited. This allows Japan to do more on its own on security front. And this allows Japan to do work more with other countries and partners. Third initiative Japan has taken is to diversify its security cooperation with like-minded countries who share common values and interests, in addition to the United States, most notably with Australia. Thus, Japan has taken these initiatives in foreign and security policy to do more on its own. And this I would like you to note that these initiatives were taken before Japan was told to do so. Put it in another way. Before President Trump told us to do more on ourselves. So we have taken those initiatives before the election of Mr. Trump. Now, having covered my second point, let me quickly move on to the third point, how Japan will address new uncertainties. And in fact, during discussion time, I would like to learn how Australia is going to respond to uncertainties that is emerging in this region. But let me stick to Japan, which is my job today. How will Japan address new uncertainties we are faced with? While there are numerous uncertainties, the Trump administration may touch off the greatest transformation in world politics since World War II. President Trump asserts that U.S. national interest takes the precedence over international cooperation. Tidal change could take place. Should that happen, Japan could be one of the most profoundly affected countries. However, I hasten to add that in Japan, a voice to call for support on nuclear armament following the remarks by President Trump during his electoral campaign, or to welcome withdrawal of the U.S. bases in Japan, or the call to abolish Japan-U.S. security treaty, have appeared, but these are very, very minor. Because such arguments basically benefit Japan very little. Instead of waiting the Trump administration to lay out their Japan policy or Asia policy, a majority view in Japan is to be proactive in putting our own foreign and security policy in the context of the region. And Japan can no longer afford to be passive or reactive. We could weigh back, but no longer. In this context, Prime Minister Abe and his government have taken initiatives which I have already enumerated to you without being told. But let me move on farther. In his policy speech to the Diet on January 21st, 2017, that is last month, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe stated that Japan-U.S. alliance will be the cornerstone of Japanese foreign and security policy. This remains as an unchanged principle of Japan. Japan will make efforts to maintain and strengthen our partnership with the U.S. as an ally. His policy speech has not been translated into English officially yet, so this is my translation, but the expression Japan-U.S. alliance is the cornerstone of Japanese foreign and security policy has been used over many years, and he pointed out that that won't change. He further mentioned in his Diet policy speech that partnership with countries who shares basic values of freedom, democracy, human rights and rule of law are important, and Japan will cooperate with Australia, ASEAN, and India to keep peace and prosperity of the Indo-Pacific region. The Diet speech clearly shows the current Japanese position. The security environment surrounding Japan is severe by all means, and it is not possible for Japan to deal with these security concerns on it alone. Thus, Japan needs alliance with the U.S. as well as strategic partnerships with like-minded countries, most notably with Australia. Well, my crystal ball has not been very good in predicting U.S. presidential election, Brexit, and others. Thus, at this point, I would like to refrain from making any predictions on U.S. policies with timeline. Furthermore, it is hard to predict policies of the Trump administration because foreign and security policy of President Trump is hard to predict, and some of his cabinet members say different things from what Mr. Trump said during election campaign. But as you know, U.S. Defense Secretary Mattis visited Japan last weekend and met with the Japanese Prime Minister, as well as Japanese Defense Minister and Foreign Minister. And according to the press accounts, Defense Secretary Mattis confirmed the importance of U.S.-Japan alliance, and also confirmed that Article 5 of U.S.-Japan alliance, U.S.-Japan security treaty, applies to Senkaku Islands, where Japan has an administrative rights. So this shows that U.S. Defense Secretary maintains U.S.-Japan alliance and that coverage to Senkaku Islands. For the future, Prime Minister Abe plans to visit United States and meet with President Trump on the 10th of this month, so we will learn more after his meeting. I would like to come to my last point, which I would like to spend a little more time, which is uncertainties remain, but I think it is important for Japan and Australia to work together as a keystone of the region, as a special strategic partner. I would like to allude to how Japan and Australia cooperate as a special strategic partner, the expression which we have been using since 2014. Australia has strategic partnership with many countries, including China. But this special has a special meaning, I believe, and I would like to make much of this special strategic partnership. On January 14th, 2017, Japanese Prime Minister Abe visited Sydney, here in Sydney, and met with Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. The two prime ministers agreed to enhance special strategic partnership between Australia and Japan. This is the term we have been using since 2014 to express our relations. They also agreed to enhance cooperation on Chinese assertive actions in South China Sea and abduction and nuclear development of North Korea. They also agreed to pursue deeper defense cooperation, including joint training exercises, cooperative cooperation, operations, and capacity building. The new acquisition and cross-service agreement, AXA, was signed during the visit as well. The new AXA will further facilitate mutual logistical support between the Australian Defense Force and the Japan Self-Defense Forces. The two leaders also expressed their expectation to conclude negotiations as early as feasible, preferably in 2017 on an agreement to reciprocally improve administrative policy and legal procedures. In short, reciprocal access agreement to facilitate joint operations and exercises. I am looking forward to this agreement. With this agreement, we can do more joint training, collaborative operations, and HADR, humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, smoothly and promptly. In case of contingency, this agreement will allow us to operate jointly in a swift manner, contributing to the security of the two and the region and beyond. I know this is an unprecedented agreement between the two countries, but I hope this will come in place soon. In fact, Japan and Australia participate in numerous joint exercises, which was unthinkable when I served as a co-facilitator of political security section of Japan-Australia meeting. As an illustration, Australia and U.S. have been conducting Talisman Saber exercise biannually, and in 2015, Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force participated in the exercise. U.S., Japan, and India conducts Malabar exercise. The Malabar exercise began as bilateral naval exercise between U.S. and India in 1992. Japan has participated as a member since 2007 and on a more permanent basis since 2015. I hope Australia will join in future, which will make our defense cooperation among the four tighter. Such joint exercises will certainly enhance trust among parties and interoperability for sure. An agreement on reciprocal access may expand and deepen our defense cooperation, including joint training further. Also of note is that Japan has proposed a free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. This was proposed first at the time of TICAD, African Development Conference in August 2016 in Nairobi, Kenya. This is to link two oceans of Pacific and Indian Ocean and two continents of Asia and Africa to produce peace, stability, and prosperity. I trust Japan and Australia can promote further security cooperation in the Indo-Pacific. On a global security cooperation, both Japan and Australia have been supportive of the United Nations. I do not know how keen President Trump is in supporting activities of the United Nations. but all the more because of that, I hope Japan and Australia can work together. We are facing fragility in every corner of the world, and it is important to prevent bloody, violent conflicts and to resolve conflicts in a peaceful manner. If conflicts develop into violent ones, it is also important to make efforts on peacemaking and peace building. Japan and Australia have been working together in UN peacekeeping operations. Are you aware of that? Good. Where are we working together? Well, that wasn't UN peacekeeping operations, but more of a we worked side by side, but in short, we have been protected by Australian Defence Force, and we are very grateful. Are there any examples? Korea, not quite to that extent, but of course, we worked together. And more recently, in year 2013, I went to observe UN peace operations in South Sudan. And I visited the Japanese Self-Defense Force there and met with two Australian Defense Force personnel. And I have learned that ADF and Japanese SDF are working together in South Sudan as a part of our MIS in order to assist the peace building of that country. South Sudan is not stable yet. President and vice president group is fighting each other. We are trying to make it more peaceful, and efforts are underway. But we were working together really in that setting. So we came afar from my first exposure to Japan-Australia Security Cooperation in year 2000. We should continue such collaborative efforts and should strive to strengthen them. As we need to send our people to more dangerous places than ever for peace operations, we need to consider why and how we would like to fulfill our responsibility. Well, time is running out, so let me shorten my speech, but allow me to touch on regional cooperation. Japan and Australia have been instrumental in promoting multi-layered regional cooperation in collaboration with ASEAN, which has taken a central role in building and managing regional architectures. East Asia Summit is one of such examples. With the tide of globalization, Asian states have significantly increased their efforts to cooperate on security matters. They have established a numerous multi-layered array of regional institutions, architectures, and processes. And there are harsh criticisms of these institutions doing just talking and no action. However, we should note that these institutions have deepened the spirit of cooperation and have enhanced confidence amongst countries in the region. Japan wishes to work together with Australia, who has been a key player in promoting multilateralism. I trust multilateralism does matter today than ever. Japan has also been active in capacity building assistance, and we have collaborated with Australia in Southeast Asia and Mongolia. Japan is now providing very interesting capacity building to troops in Papua New Guinea. This is a musical band. They would like to perform when they host APEC Summit. And Japan has a very good musical band, and we are helping them. This is a laughing matter. But capacity building assistance do help their stability, I hope. And in exploring further Japan-Australia security cooperation, science and technology will be a new field. And this is something that we might be able to pursue further. In closing, I would like to note that we differ on some accounts. Our threat perceptions are not necessarily in sync on all issues. In Japanese opinion poll by the Cabinet Office conducted in October 2016, 87% responded that Japan-US relations are good, while 9.8% said bad. On Japan-China relations, 83% said China-Japan relations are bad, while 12.5% said good. In Australia, the Lowy Institute poll in 2016 reported that 71% said US-Australia alliance is important. When Australians were asked which relationship is more important to Australia, US or China, 43% said US and 43% said China. Also, China had a clear lead over Japan as Australia's best friend in Asia. 30% said China and 25% said Japan. This shows our perceptions differ. And whatever differences we might have in our perceptions, if we perceive that we have common stake in peace and security and prosperity in the region, I think we have potential to work together for deeper, special strategic partnership. When we have a new leader in scene, we have a temptation to overreact. I, for one, would like to refrain from reacting to bits and pieces. I would like to see Japan to co-lead with Australia as the northern and southern anchors of the U.S. alliance system in the region, which should be beyond hub and spoke, but more of a network type in future. As like-minded allies of the United States, we can be a keystone of stability, upholding liberal rule-based order and encouraging U.S. to maintain their leadership and presence. Our special strategic partnership will certainly enhance regional stability. Finally, I would like to note that even the largest countries cannot, without international collaboration, effectively deal with cross-border global issues such as refugees, displaced persons, infectious disease, natural disasters, climate change, and international organized crime. Japan should continue to advocate widely for moral and practical utility of multilateral framework. And I think we should work together, forging deeper special strategic partnership. I'm reminded that our national rugby team did quite well in the last World Cup in 2015. Do you still remember that? I had a chance to meet Australian head coach, Eddie Jones, last year, and he told me how difficult it was to train the team together. But he told me that was feasible. If rugby can do it, why can't we for peace and security in the region and beyond? That's my point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Fukushima. If you'd like to stay at the podium. You've already demonstrated, I think, in your clear grasp of detail, the many points that go up to make the depth in Australia-Japan security cooperation. I make no secret of the fact that I think it's a good thing, and it's something I've tracked closely since joining the Institute, and for many years before then, as a student in Australia, originally tracking Japan's maritime security. But I think we also need to keep our focus on recent events. So without being overly negative, one question I wanted to ask you from the start is, having tracked that, last year, one of the major developments in our bilateral relationship was over the acquisition of a submarine that was expected widely to go to Japan, which in the end went to France instead, which disappointed many supporters of the bilateral relationship. To what extent really was that an obstacle within the relationship? What were its impacts? How was it felt in Japan? And are we over that hurdle now?
And thank you, Dr. Graham. I was very much disappointed with the result because I spent my time and energy to change old three principles which banned export of defense technology and equipment. And I spent a lot of my brain power in order to come up with the new principles. So I was very much disappointed, and many of us are disappointed. But if we just live in the hole of a disappointment, we cannot make any progress. So I think many of us were very much disappointed, but have emerged from the disappointment and trying to find a way forward. New principles are still new. But it's still very young, it's still a baby, and companies, Japanese companies, are trying to learn how to use new principles. So it's a very sad turnout, but many of us are trying to find a way forward. Acquisition would be a good way to move forward in a sustainable manner. So if we can work for another acquisition, that's all the better. But it totally depends on defense planning of Australia. So I'm wondering whether we can do more on science and military related, science and technology development side, which may help us each other. You have a wonderful testing ground here, Umera, and we might be able to do something together. Disappointments are there, and it's a scar in my heart, but we are trying to find a way forward. That's my view.
Thank you. We've got a little over 20 minutes for question and answer, so without further delay, I'd like to open it up to the floor for your questions and comments. Could you please just identify yourself, your affiliation if you have any, and keep your question short and to the point? Gentleman in the back row there.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I'm a student at the University of Melbourne. Thank you for your speech, Professor Fukushima. Japan and Australia were instrumental in the development of APEC, a multilateral institution in which shared economic interests were at the core. You mentioned that Japan and Australia have been advocating for further security cooperation in ASEAN through the East Asia Summit. However, the Indo-Pacific lacks a comprehensive multilateral institution akin to NATO. Do you think Japan and Australia could lead the way in developing an institution like NATO in the Indo-Pacific? Do you think it would be useful?
That's a great question. I'll just park it there and take a second question. I see one from the floor. Yes, gentleman in the second row. Just wait till the microphone comes.
Thank you. My name is John West. I actually teach at Sophia University in Tokyo.
Oh, really?
So it's wonderful to see you, and congratulations on the excellent speech.
Thank you.
In the excellent presentation of Japan-Australia cooperation, you didn't mention Korea. And Korea is another democracy in the region and a close partner of Australia. It would be a natural candidate to work together.
Yes.
And could you offer some comments on the potential role of Korea? South Korea, of course.
Thank you. Thank you for those two excellent questions. In response to Charlie's question, Indo-Pacific is a large, huge region, and this is my personal view, rather than jumping on to creation of an architecture like NATO in Indo-Pacific, I would like to see Australia and Japan to identify what we can do together in Indo-Pacific, because Australia faces both Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean, right? And Japan faces Pacific Ocean. So, but can do many things together. So in terms of maritime security, which Yuan is the specialist, there are so many things that we can do together. So by identifying specific cooperation infrastructure included, there are many ways to work together. And by having some of those pieces together, we may go to another stage of talking about architecture. If I may confess, I have been working on multilateralism all the year through from my PhD dissertation. And I'm a bit more cautious about creating new architectures rather than trying to find the substance of a multilateral cooperation. And it has land space as well as sea space in the vision. Consul Jongo, is our vision available on our website in Indo-Pacific? If you can visit the Japanese Foreign Ministry website, is it? There is our vision of open Indo-Pacific vision. So if you can read that, you might be able to have a sense of what we would like to achieve. Thank you for the question.
Could I just jump in on the back of Charlie's question, that there is something between bilateralism and multilateralism. Mm-hmm. Bilateral is, of course, the bedrock of security, the hubs and spoke alliances, and bilateral partnership between Australia and Japan. Multilateralism, APEC was the example you gave. East Asia Summit was the example you gave. But in between, we have something called minilateralism. Mm-hmm. Minilateralism may, in my view, be the way that that things actually progress rather than at the overarching layer of
architecture. Like a trilateral or a quad.
Or the quad in particular. And I was thinking, given that we've had quite a lot of interest from the new Indian government, the Modi government, where you saw Japan's view on the potential for something like the quad or other minilateral security pieces of the architecture.
Huge multilateralism is difficult to move, but plurilateralism, do we call it? Trilateral, quadrilateral are something that we can move with specific objectives. So those are very useful. If I may turn to the second question from academic colleague from Sofia University. I couldn't identify your name, I'm sorry. Your point is very important. In the interest of time, I focused on Japan, Australia, but Japan, Korea is an important bilateral relationship, and Korea, of course, is a U.S. ally, and Japan is a U.S. ally, Australia is a U.S. ally. So some sort of a network is important, and we have a new information agreement with Korea, I mean South Korea. Therefore, I would like to see that develop further. It is sad to see a current Korean political situations. I hope it would stabilize soon so that we can work together with the South Korean colleagues and government as well. I think it is very important for us to work with them as well.
And I should mention that the last event that I was involved in at the Institute just last week was actually bringing together a set of Australian and South Korean emerging leaders, and we were talking there about the importance of that and potential of that bilateral relationship, but also in the, perhaps not the near term, but in the long term context, the potential for trilateralizing that, I think, has an obvious resonance if those political obstacles can be overcome.
I also agree. Those triangles laid out on top of each other would be very helpful as well.
My name's Jeff Miller. I'm from the Institute of International Affairs. Just a question. Listed the countries that you hoped would cooperate together, Australia, Japan, India, ASEAN, so on. And, of course, they all leave out the great dilemma and the huge country involved, namely China. I wonder, have you concluded that as a very broad strategy, there's no point... one obvious possible strategy would be to try to involve China in everything that other countries do in the area, and by involving them, co-opt them, so on and so on. Have you concluded that that's not a possible strategy?
No. thank you for the question so that I can clarify. Well, I listed those countries in terms of the practicum of immediate security cooperation with like-minded countries. But I did not exclude China for our security cooperation. In fact, my Chinese colleagues, I have very good friends in China, academic friends, who may not agree with me in official meetings, but we have a great time talking to each other over drinks and meals. And whenever I complain about East China Sea and South China Sea, they come back by and rule of law, they always come back by saying that, Kiki, you do not understand China. China is a major contributor to international peace. You know, we are sending 3,000, not 300, that's Japanese number, 3,000 peacekeepers, and we have many victims from it. And I have heard it maybe 100 times by now. And I do respect Chinese efforts to send peacekeepers to UN peacekeeping operations. It is quite a thing to send 3,000 individuals. And we have new Secretary General at United Nations, and there are many countries who are looking anew at their peace operations. Canada is one example. Canada has, as you know, stepped down from sending their people to peace operations. They have closed Lester Pearson Center. But under Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, they have announced a new policy to send personnel to peace operations, mainly to Francophone Africa, in the order of 600. And UK is going to send their engineers, military engineers, to South Sudan this year, in order to help peace building. And all these countries, as well as Nordic countries, are contacting me to find out whether we can discuss what kind of peace operations we should deploy in future under the new leadership of the Secretary General. And we all agree that we should include Chinese colleagues because they are contributing that much. So I have asked the Japanese government to start consultations bilateral with Chinese counterparts on peace operations, how we can do things together or how we can think of peace operations together, and he is going to do it soon. So there are things we cannot do together, like rule of law in South China Sea, but there are other things we can do together in international security, and that's something I would like to see China as well as others involved. So depending on the topic, security topic, there are things we should be able to do. In addition, Japan is not antagonistic to China at all. When we look back our history, when we resumed our diplomatic relations with PRC, the opinion poll showed that many of us, maybe 80%, welcomed our relationship with China, and we are all for China. When Tiananmen Square incident took place in 1989, Japan was the country who tried to support China, and we started to resume our official development assistance first in the international community. After that, China decided to take a education policy which is more anti-Japanese. But we are making our efforts, including Prime Minister, to have better relations with China. There is no point for us to be against China. We are trying to talk and solve issues. So I don't want to leave the impression that we are against China all the way through.
One of the practical consequences of the new Japanese legislation enabling collective self-defense is to allow Japanese peacekeepers to use minimum force to protect not only themselves but those alongside them in multinational peacekeeping operations. That, of course, in theory, could include China.
Of course. So
when China complains, the scenario I wonder about is if in future in South Sudan or somewhere else, if the Chinese contingent finds themselves being attacked, then, and if the Japanese are alongside, then it's surely in the self-interest of China to make sure that they have their flank covered. I'll take another couple of questions. Two ladies there next to each other.
I'm Kari Takahashi from the Nikkei Japanese Media. I was just wondering, how do you see the recent event between Turnbull and Trump, the conversation over the phone? And I learned that Japanese Prime Minister Abe has a good relationship with Trump compared to that. So my question is, how do you see that, and what's the difference as the same ally to the United States? And also, I'd like to know, if you could, about the TPP strategy of Japanese government now. So is there, do you see any difference from the strategy of Australia?
Francis Kitt from the Lowy Institute. Thank you very much for a really informative lecture. My question is also about the TPP. Mm-hmm. Australia and Japan are both founding members. So despite the US position, does the TPP still have a role in addressing, uncertainty and insecurity? You know, can it be something that can go forward from here?
Thank you for the three questions, and those are the questions I would like to ask, as a matter of fact. Takahashi-san, thank you for your question. I was not there when President Trump and Prime Minister Turnbull spoke over the phone. I just read from the press accounts that they had a very animated exchange with the sudden end of the conversation. I really don't know. And I really don't know the agreement itself about refugees in Nauru.
Nauru and Manus Island in Papua New Guinea.
I really don't know the details of that agreement, so I really cannot judge. I was not there when Prime Minister Abe met President Trump for the first time, and I will not be there when they're going to meet. So what I can learn from their conversation is through you. So I'm not, I cannot comment on the relationship, but or compare the relationship between the two.
Could I press you a little bit, though, because it does appear clear that it was not the way people expected it to be. People expected the tension more to be on Japan-US relations rather than Australia-US relations. So was there surprise in Japan that the Prime Minister got on as well as he did?
Well, Prime Minister, as well as our embassy in Washington, D.C., made strenuous efforts to have a good meeting between the two. And U.S. matters for Japan. We are protected by U.S.-Japan alliance, and we make every effort to have a solid relation with them. But I cannot compare Prime Minister Turnbull and Prime Minister Abe when it comes to their relations with President Trump. When Prime Minister Turnbull meets President Trump face to face, their communication might be different. So I just can't tell anything more than that, but I hope President Trump would behave slightly better. Don't quote me. Oh, this is on the record. And on TPP, I don't think Japanese position has not changed. And I really, Takahashi-san, you're with Nikkei, so you know better than I do. But do you think protectionism would prevail for a longer haul? I know America passed, but I really, as a student of multilateralism, I really wonder, today is the day for protectionism. When the business is globalized, can we just say that this is Japan, Japan's business, nothing else? Can we say that? And can we really expect for prosperity? TPP has been negotiated with the leadership of Australia and signed finally, and it is a good agreement. So personally, it is a pity that Mr. Trump signed his executive order. And I have never seen a president who signed so many executive orders in 2 weeks, is it? I'm sorry, I cannot give you any intelligent response to TPP question. Francis, your question was TPP. What kind of role TPP can play? Well, we have gone through TPP negotiations. So we have identified problems, and we have created solutions to it. And I hope we will not put it in the, how you call it, the West paper basket. But I would like to see it used in a different reincarnation in the region for the better of the region's economy. But more than that, at this point of time, I'm confused and cannot say anything more. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Professor Fukushima. I'm afraid we're at the end of our allotted time now. And as you've heard before, we pride ourselves on finishing on time at the Lowy Institute. So it just remains for me to thank Professor Fukushima for her time, her insights, also to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Japan for sponsoring this event. And to you for your questions, your comments, and your time in coming here to the Institute today. So just remains for me to thank Professor Fukushima, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Graham, and I would like to thank each and every one of you for coming over to this talk, despite the rain, which I have never seen in Sydney. Thank you so much.